With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with the Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we'll talk about the latest film and TV news. We'll have a quick conversation about Nobody 2, and then we'll get into some listener emails. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And yes, this week is going to be a pretty chill, low-key episode of the show. We don't have any big interviews or anything. There's not really a ton going on in the world of big new releases or anything. That's actually going to hold true for next week as well. But it's just me for the news section here. So let's just go ahead and run down a few of these items. First up, Severance Season 3. We found out recently that Ben Stiller, who's one of the EPs of the show, he is one of the main creative voices behind it alongside Dan Erickson, the showrunner. Stiller has directed several episodes of the series thus far, and he is not going to be directing any of Severance Season 3. Instead, he's going to be working on a lot of things. He's shooting Focker in Law, which is a Meet the Parents sequel. He is working on a new show for Apple TV Plus that is a documentary about his parents, Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. He's working on a TV show for HBO called The Band. He's working on a World War II movie about the true story of a downed airman in occupied France and how he got involved with the French Resistance. And he's also working on a project based on a Rachel Maddow podcast called Bagman that's about Vice President Spiro Agnew. So, yeah, very busy dude at this point. So he just straight up does not have time to direct any of Severance Season 3. I think that's okay. I think the roster, the bench is probably pretty deep over there at this point, and he's established a look of the show that other filmmakers can come in and copy and kind of put their spin on. If you think back to Season 2, the episode Chikai Bardo, which was directed by Jessica Lee Gagne, the show's cinematographer, that's a great example of somebody else coming in and doing something really distinctive with the look of the show that's a little outside the usual of what Stiller established. So I think there are opportunities for Severance to still look great without Ben Stiller there literally behind the camera in Season 3. So stay tuned for that. There's a little bit of good news here, which is hundreds of classic Looney Tunes episodes now have a new streaming home, at least temporarily. So I'm not sure how closely people followed this news, but several of the Looney Tunes shorts that were on HBO Max at one point were removed around the time that David Zaslav was just cutting everything, canceling finished movies, just going on a tirade trying to make as much money for the company as possible or prevent them from spending as much money as possible. And so fans have had to find other ways to track down these episodes. But as of now, Tubi, the free streaming service, has 786 of the classic Looney Tunes episodes, which can be watched right now, which is really amazing. And that's more episodes than HBO Max ever had. So very good news for people who were really disappointed with the way that HBO Max treated the, what some could say, the crown jewel of animation for all of Warner Brothers. So there's that. Check them out on Tubi if you're interested. Speaking of HBO Max, though, the streaming service has now made itself a destination for anime fans. Recently, word came out that HBO Max is teaming up with G Kids to add several high-profile anime films to the HBO Max library. Some of those include three Makoto Shinkai films, Children Who Chase Lost Voices, The Place Promised in Our Early Days, and the 4K version of Your Name. I definitely recommend Your Name and The Place Promised in Our Early Days. I've not seen Children Who Chase Lost Voices yet, but for what little I know about anime, and I'm certainly far from an expert. I've barely dipped my toe into that world, but Makoto Shinkai is certainly one of the premier voices in that space. So check out his work if you've not seen it, especially Your Name. So that's kind of a coup for HBO Max. And then later this year, and I think throughout next year, they're going to be getting several other major movies, including Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress, which, again, two movies that are just incredible. And I actually talked recently about seeing Perfect Blue for the first time on an episode of Pop Cultured, the other podcast that I do over at patreon.com/popcultured. So if you want to hear me talk more about that, HT and I had a really good conversation about the prescience of Satoshi Kon as a filmmaker. And she loves Millennium Actress. She turned me on to that movie many years ago. And yeah, really, really incredible stuff there. So that's just a tiny fraction of the stuff that's going to be on there. So yeah, stay tuned for more of that if you're a fan of anime and or want to dip your toe into that world. HBO Max seems like a good place to do that. A new World War Z movie might actually be happening. This is something that has been pretty much talked about since the first film came out in 2013. Mark Forster directed that, but there have been several attempts to make a World War Z 2. David Fincher was really close to making one at one point, and that ended up falling apart like right at the last second. But now that there are new people in charge of Paramount, apparently World War Z is a priority for the studio alongside things like Star Trek and Transformers and Top Gun 3. So World War Z 2, it sounds like we can actually expect that to happen. So no release date or anything yet, but if you're one of those people who was really bummed when that project came almost up to the starting blocks and then fell away, it seems like maybe the likelihood of it happening is actually higher now than it ever was before. Moving on, Zack Snyder is returning to the world of movies. He is working on a project called The Last Photograph, which is a film that he has been developing for many, many years. It's gone through several different iterations with different people attached over the years. It looks like Stuart Martin and Fra Fee, who both appeared in Rebel Moon for Snyder, are going to be starring in this movie. I'm not super interested in them as performers because I don't really know much about them. I did not see any of the Rebel Moon movies, any of the cuts or anything that Netflix released for that. Zack Snyder, obviously a very polarizing figure, but the story for this sounds a little bit more grounded and intimate than some of the stuff that he's made before. The story follows an ex-DEA operative who must return to the mountains of South America in an effort to find his missing niece and nephew following the brutal murders of their diplomat parents. Enlisting the help of a washed-up junkie war photographer, the only person to have seen the face of the killers, he sets out determined to find the children and the truth, but soon learns he must also face the ghosts of his past. There's something in here about how the distinction between real and surreal could become a little bit blurred. So that would be kind of a fascinating turn for Snyder, who's mostly worked in these really big, splashy images. He's a really fantastic visualist. We've talked about this on the podcast before. He's really great at kind of recreating the comic book aesthetic, the splash page nature of that. And this sounds much more grounded than any of the big superhero stuff or big sci-fi epics that he's worked on in the past. So I'm curious to see what he does there and how different it ends up looking than his previous work. And there's a chance that it ends up being great. I mean, I probably dunked on Zack Snyder a lot in the years that I've been doing this podcast, but I don't think he's like a truly lost cause or anything. I just think he has put his passions and efforts in places that don't necessarily align with my personal interests. So I think there's certainly a chance that he could come out and release something that I think is fantastic again. So I'm really hoping that that ends up happening. It sounds like at least over the past several years, The Last Photograph might be the best opportunity for our interests to align, or at least for him to make something that is maybe like a little bit more aesthetically interesting to me personally. So if anybody happens to share my feelings on Zack Snyder, then yeah, maybe kind of quietly cross your fingers for The Last Photograph. We'll see how that one turns out. I'm not super excited about this next project. I just wanted to mention it real quick because it's a Danny Boyle movie, and I'm a big fan of Danny Boyle's, and I think he is one of the most impressive directors in terms of being able to hop around in different genres and make different types of movies, movies that look and feel totally distinct from each other, which is a skill and a talent that filmmakers used to have decades and decades ago. And it seems like with the way that the industry has evolved, the industry itself has kind of beaten that out of directors a little bit because they put people in boxes and just say, hey, recreate this thing you've done before, very often anyway. So I'm glad that Danny Boyle is still out here making movies. And it sounds like his next project is going to be very, very different from 28 Years Later, which is the most recent movie that he directed. This is going to be called Ink. And evidently it's the story of Rupert Murdoch, who is the founder or creator of Fox News. He's a media mogul from Australia. And Guy Pearce is in talks to play that role. Jack O'Connell, who showed up briefly at the end of 28 Years Later, is in negotiations to play Larry Lamb, who Murdoch hired to run the Sun newspaper when he bought it back in 1969. So this is going to be a movie about a group of visionaries and misfits who had an idea for a new kind of news, one that would give people what they want and would change the face of the world we live in today. So yeah, I don't love that we live in a world that's been so heavily influenced by Rupert Murdoch as a personality and his business decisions. But if Danny Boyle thinks there's something to the story, I'm cautiously willing to maybe see what he has working there. So again, that's going to be called Ink. Stay tuned for more on that. The Duffer Brothers have closed a 4-year film, TV, and streaming mega deal with Paramount. I don't remember if we talked about this last week or not, so apologies for rehashing any details if we did, but this deal has actually closed now, and there are a few more details, just the fact that it's a 4-year exclusive deal for films, TV, and streaming projects. So yeah, the Duffer Brothers are the creators of Stranger Things, and they are going to be able to continue to work on Stranger Things related spinoffs and things like that at Netflix. They actually have a few more shows in the works over at Netflix. They're going to be able to continue working on those shows while also developing some new stuff for Paramount or working on new projects for Paramount. One of the big draws for them was that Paramount is offering them the ability to make theatrical films. So that seems to be a big deal for them. This new deal begins in April of next year. So congrats to them for making this big deal. And I'm hopeful that whatever they end up getting slotted into over at Paramount, I presume it'll be some sort of big franchise that the studio wants to prioritize, ends up turning out great, because I would love for these guys to basically move out of the Stranger Things universe now that they've launch that and wrapping up the main story. And I'm sure maybe they can stay on as executive producers or something, or like give notes or whatever on future projects. But I would like to see them step out, and it would just be really cool if we had an exciting new quote unquote voice on the film scene, because these guys have been around for a long time, but I don't think they've really been given the opportunity to make anything on a major scale for the world of movies quite yet. So I'm hoping they're not like a one-hit wonder or anything like that, just because it would be better for everyone if they weren't. So I'm pulling for them. And then finally, David Leitch, the director of The Fall Guy and Atomic Blonde and Hobbs and Shaw, boo! And he co-directed the first John Wick movie. He is working on a new movie for Amazon MGM Studios that's going to be called The Pirate, from a writer named Will Dunn, who worked on Ms. Marvel, the Marvel series. And this movie, The Pirate, is described as the raid set on a pirate ship, which sounds rad as hell, if you ask me. And evidently, Jason Momoa is involved in some capacity. It seems like he's in negotiations to produce right now, but if the deal closes, it seems like it would be developed as a potential starring vehicle for him, and Leitch could end up directing this. So if that ends up happening, if those pieces end up falling into place, that could be a really fun project. I'm a little hit or miss on David Leitch's filmography, but when he is on, he really hits for me. I loved The Fall Guy, even though apparently most of America decided to sit that film out for whatever reason. It's completely baffling to me still. If you've not seen The Fall Guy, please go watch that movie. It's really, really good. I promise you'll have fun. Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt, just a really, really great time. So that's all the news we have today. And let's jump into a quick conversation about Nobody 2.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
With me now to talk about Nobody 2, we have Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, I have to be completely honest with you. I was not a big fan of the first Nobody, so I did not see this sequel. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was in that period, that kind of post-John Wick period, where I felt like a lot of the action in Hollywood was starting to lose its luster a little bit because of the kind of sameness that came from other studios and other companies being like, oh, this is what action can look like now, and just trying to do that, but not doing it quite as well. And I realize that's ironic to say because 8711, which is the stunt company that's created by Chaz Stahelski and David Leitch, are the same folks who worked on the original Nobody. So it just kind of felt like an imitation of their own work to me. And the novelty of seeing Bob Odenkirk as an action star didn't really do much for me. I mean, I saw that first movie and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is fine. But it just didn't really light me up as a viewer. So I did not see the second movie, but you did. And I wanted to ask you about it. So tell me what you thought about Nobody 2.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I will say that I really dug the first Nobody. I thought it was kind of a compelling, you know, fun and interesting dad approach to John Wick with Bob Odenkirk in that lead role, you know. He brings a great mix of comedic sensibilities and, you know, having this overall dad vibe about him. And also he's, you know, surprisingly adept at the action as well. It was just a familiar but story with action that I felt was well enough executed that it made for an entertaining movie. And so with Nobody 2, it's not as good as the first one. I feel like they probably could have done things to make it a little more engaging and kind of similar to what John Wick did by bringing you deeper into the world of, you know, underground assassins and the Continental and stuff. It felt like he kind of still played it close to the surface and just took us to a different location. The best way to describe it is it's like Nobody meets National Lampoon's Vacation, because Bob Odenkirk takes his family on a vacation to this small, like, mini tourist town called Plumerville. And there's basically, like, you know, a water park and, like, a little carnival and an arcade and stuff like that. And it's just, like, a little quaint family summer getaway place. And he remembers going to it when he was a kid. One of the, like, the few, you know, trips that, you know, he took with his dad, played by Christopher Lloyd, as, you know, a family, and he had fun there. But of course, because, you know, he's nobody, he gets caught up in some trouble, and there's a sneaky weapons and drug smuggling cartel that runs through this town, and there's plenty of action, and Sharon Stone plays the primary villain in it, and Colin Hanks plays a surprisingly douchebag sheriff who's also a villain in it, which was an interesting turn for him. Overall, I had fun watching it, but it's also quite forgettable, and it kind of doesn't really make good use of Sharon Stone as a villain. She's clearly having fun with what she has, but I wish that there was more to her character and she was able to do more as a villain, because there wasn't anything that was, like, incredibly memorable about the character.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I understand what you're talking about plot-wise, but what about the action? Because I think that's maybe why people go to a movie like this. And sometimes if a movie can deliver on the action, you can basically have a good enough time just with that, even if some of the story stuff is a little bit underwhelming. So I know that Timo Jahanto is the director of this one. He came in, and I think he's an Indonesian filmmaker. He directed The Night Comes for Us, which is a Netflix movie back in 2018. He's directed several segments in the VHS franchise that we've talked about before on the podcast. He's like a very acclaimed action filmmaker. And so how did the action stack up in Nobody 2 versus the first movie?
The action's still pretty good. Much like the movie itself, I would say not quite as good. You know, there's a great standout sequence in the opening. The first, like I would say 15 minutes has a great establishing action sequence. And then the final act has a pretty good sequence, you know, set in the like amusement park setting of Plumerville and whatnot. Kind of feels a little bit like Zombieland in a way. And there's good fight sequences and, you know, some pretty brutal, kills and moments in combat and whatnot. Still bloody, still hard hitting. And that part, you know, still works pretty well.
Okay. Well, yeah, you mentioned Colin Hanks. I was curious if you had any other standouts from the cast, anybody who actually was given some fun stuff to work with here. It sounds like Sharon Stone was a little bit disappointing through no fault of her own, but anybody else stand out to you?
Colin Hanks was the one that I was really surprised to see him take on a role like this. Cause if I recall, I really haven't seen him do a character that's like straight up dislikable and just like a straight up, you know, villain asshole. So that was interesting to see. It feels like they get, that there was maybe something more for Connie Nielsen's character that might have ended up like on the cutting room floor or something that like was cut out of the script or something like that. Cause it feels like there's maybe a hint at something else bubbling in her history and maybe from her past with Bob Odenkirk's character Hutch that hasn't been touched upon yet, but it never really goes anywhere except for like a key moment in the sequel that helps, you know, resolve the main threat in the end of the movie. John Ortiz is also in it as a villain, but he's also not given a ton to do except kind of just be an angry dad who inherited a criminal ring. Sharon Stone is kind of the main boss overseeing it. Of course, RZA is back, you know, which is, it's always fun to see him pop up. But yeah, otherwise it's a sequel that kind of just like it treads water, basically. You know, it's enjoyable while you're watching it. It's not the kind of thing where like you probably won't remember a lot about it, you know, and you know you might throw it on in the background when it's on TV, but it's I wish that it did a little more to like just dig into this world of Nobody and like expand, you know, the what's interesting about the characters and the situation.
Yeah, do you think that there's any opportunities for a third movie? Is that something that you would be excited to see them try to continue this universe?
I would at least be interested in seeing what they can do and with the hope that, you know, they realize that there is more to explore here rather than just trying to repeat the action formula of Hutch having to deal with bad guys and protect his family and, you know, giving some of the other characters more to do, you know, because like if there's one interesting, I guess, like small thing that it does with the character, and it kind of falls by the wayside when compared to like what happens with just the plot of the sequel, is that there's this idea that like Hutch wants his son to be better than he is. And in the same way that Christopher Lloyd, you know, wanted Hutch to be better than him, but he ended up following in the exact same footsteps and getting the exact same kind of job and being stuck in these situations. But it doesn't dig into it enough to be like significant. So like, I don't know, if there were a third movie, you could do something more with that aspect of his son's life. But I think the more interesting thing, like I mentioned, is something with Connie Nielsen's character that like digs more into their past and reveals more about what they've done since they've been together. Or maybe that, you know, she has some kind of other secret that hasn't been revealed yet, kind of like he did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would at least be interested to see if they could pull something else off.
Okay. Well, I mean, this sounds like a perfect like Sunday afternoon, lazy, laying around the couch, watch it on TBS kind of movie. Is that that's the vibe I'm getting? Would you categorize that as accurate?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay. So would you recommend people wait to see it, or go see it on a Tuesday or Wednesday at an AMC when tickets are $5? Or like, what would you say for people who are maybe on the fence?
Yeah, I would say if you have AMC Stubs or whatever, any of the other movie ticket subscription things, or if you go on a discount day, that's probably your best option to see it in theaters. But otherwise, it's not one you got to rush out and see, I don't think.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Brad. I appreciate your time. All right, just me again here. I want to run through one listener email before I am joined again by somebody else to go over a different one. Lorenzo wrote in responding to our conversation about James Gunn's Superman. We talked about a bunch of things on that episode. I remember one of the things we were talking about was the kind of operational center that Lex Luthor had set up and like the lackeys that he had running the computers and the operations and all that in his office space and stuff. So Lorenzo writes in, he says, Lex's employee with the mustache is a character named Sidney Happerson. He was introduced during John Byrne's post-crisis Superman run, and he worked with Lex there in the comics too. So I think we had some this is Ben, again, I'm interrupting Lorenzo's email. We must have had some questions on that episode about who the heck this guy was. So Lorenzo, hopefully answering that question. Thank you very much. All right, back to his email. James Gunn has lamented having locked himself into using Adam Warlock in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 after setting that character up in a credit scene in Volume 2, and is therefore trying to move away from using credit scenes to set the stage for future projects. This, I think, explains why he opted to introduce Supergirl prior to the credits rolling on Superman. As for the way in which Supergirl is depicted in her cameo, her upcoming film is based on Tom King's Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow series, which begins with Supergirl getting drunk on a planet with a red sun, as alluded to in her cameo. With regards to Lobo's role in the Supergirl movie, I don't think we can really say with much certainty that Kara and Lobo will be quote-unquote teaming up. And I'm just interrupting here to say that I'm pretty sure I categorized it that way. So apologies if I messed up. Let's get back to Lorenzo's email. Lobo was not in the Woman of Tomorrow comics. While Tom King initially planned to use Lobo in that run, he did not wind up making it in when all was said and done. However, based on those comics, I think it's pretty easy to surmise how Lobo might be incorporated into the film adaptation, and it's not as an ally to Kara. I think that Lobo will sort of be competing with Supergirl to get to Krim, the big bad of the comic and presumably the movie, first to collect a bounty on him. Lobo is an anti-hero, so perhaps by the end of the film he will wind up on Supergirl's side, but I think he will mostly be an antagonist in the movie. All right, and then the last point that Lorenzo says, he's just addressing something that we were not thrilled by in the new Superman movie. He says, I was shocked to hear you guys weren't fond of the song choice during the Mr. Terrific fight scene. I think that song is lovely. It feels like it could have come right off the 51st Dates soundtrack. All right, well, thank you very much to Lorenzo for writing in there. Confession time, I have not seen 51st Dates. I missed that movie. It's been on my list for a while. It's been slowly climbing my watch list, so I'm probably going to check it out pretty soon. Maybe if I do, I'll try to remember to weigh in here on this podcast. But I missed that one, and I know it has a lot of fans. So the reference went over my head this time, Lorenzo, but thank you for writing in regardless. All right, now it's time to get somebody else involved. Joining me now is Slash Film staff writer Bill Bria.
Hey, hey, how's it going?
I'm doing great, Bill. Thank you so much for joining. And as listeners will soon discover, I picked you for a very specific reason to talk about this email. So Wes from Dallas-Fort Worth wrote in and said, just wanted to get some help with selecting physical media. I would like to get back into buying Blu-rays, but this time I plan to be very selective and only get the best quality versions. When shopping for them, I see that it's become a mess as there's just basic movies on Blu-ray, there's special features Blu-rays, and then there are those like the Tombstone re-release that is probably the best quality you'll be able to find it in. So my questions are, what do I look for on the box to know that this is actually the very best version of a film and that I'm not just buying a standard copy that was out on Blu-ray? Could you do a ranking of the best Blu-rays that have the definitive versions of a movie? With bandwidth speeds increasing, do you think streaming from Netflix or iTunes will ever get to the same quality as these Blu-rays? And off topic, any chance we'll ever get to see the 120 frames per second version of Gemini Man somewhere, especially since many TVs now support this? So, Bill, I'm just going to give you my very brief understanding of how this stuff works, and then I'm going to let you go because you know way more about all of this and the Blu-ray market and physical media than I do. So in terms of there being different levels of Blu-ray, I was under the impression that a Blu-ray is a Blu-ray in terms of quality kind of across the board. Of course, there are different special features and things like that, you know, in terms of like, if you go to Criterion and get a Blu-ray, you're probably going to get a Blu-ray that has a lot of great high quality special features on it. And if you grab one from Walmart or something, there's the chance that it might just have the movie and maybe a trailer or something like that on it. You know, there are distinctive levels in terms of that stuff from edition to edition. But in terms of the movie itself, every Blu-ray should have the same quality of the movie on it, right? Or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. In terms of, so I think I have to break this email down because it is asking a wide variety of questions and the answers are not succinct because
okay. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah,
it's not a
catch-all answer for sure. I think in general, what I'd like to say in response to the email is like, it's great that this guy, I think his name's Wes, right? It's
yes.
great that he wants to get back into collecting. It's great that he wants to get the best bang for his buck, so to speak. And I do overall unequivocally believe that if you're a cinephile, if you're a movie fan and you want to own your favorite movies, you want to dive into your favorite movies in terms of, you know, their history and their making of, you just want to, you know, be able to have it at your fingertips. You absolutely want to invest in physical media because as convenient as streaming is, you know, obviously we know that there's so much that you're not getting there and there's potential for it to be lost in the future. Whereas mm-hmm. unless you physically lose the disc or physically, you know, injure the disc somehow, you're going to generally have that for most of your lifetime to come. So just using his example of the Tombstone re-release as an example, as a sort of a something to use as a baseline, mm-hmm. that is its own specific case because as he mentions, that re-release that Disney just did as a 4K restoration, if you're talking about just the movie by itself in terms of its baseline, theatrical cut version, theatrically released version, the picture quality and the sound quality, then yes, that 4K release, which just happened over the course of this past year, is absolutely the definitive version of that version of the movie. Now, I'm choosing my words carefully there because there is a different cut of Tombstone that does exist. However, it is not available on that 4K release. It is dubbed the director's cut. If anyone knows about the history of the making of Tombstone, you'll understand why that labels might be sounding dubious because we won't make this podcast about Tombstone, but there's a whole history there in terms of the making of that movie and director's authorship and who had mm-hmm. to do with what. That's, you know, you have to check the Wikipedia page for that. But suffice to say, there is a longer, slightly longer cut of the movie that was released commercially in 2002 on what was then called the Vista series, which was then Disney's version of essentially, I guess, their way to sort of compete with Criterion in a, hey, this is our movies and we're re-releasing them, but we're releasing them in a very lavish format, sort of, so to speak, mm-hmm. with, you know, special features and, you know, packaging and all that sort of thing. So if you want that version of the movie, you can only find it on out of print DVD release of the Vista series edition of Tombstone. That also contains a commentary track with director George P. Cosmatos, which is not available on the new 4K release because, again, this is a different cut of the movie, and he recorded that commentary at that time for that cut of the movie. So mm-hmm. really, this speaks to the question of what this person means and what anyone means about definitive. And if you're looking for definitive to mean just the best possible quality that this movie could be in, then pretty much every, as you were saying, Ben, every, you know, commercially released Blu-ray would have it in a very good quality. There's very few, relatively, commercial releases of a film by, you know, either a major studio or a boutique label, certainly a boutique label, but, you know, obviously even a major studio where the transfer is somehow extremely poor or so on and so forth. Obviously, if you're going into the DVD world, you know, that's a generation below Blu-ray and obviously two generations below 4K ultra high definition. So you get what you, you know, you're getting in that sense in terms of the lower resolution. But mm-hmm. I do think it's a fallacy to say that DVD is a subpar quality. It's still, I would argue, on par with streaming in terms of the picture quality and certainly the sound quality. And to sort of address another point that he brings up, do we think streaming from Netflix or iTunes will get the same quality as these Blu-rays? I would say no. I think that at times they might appear to be. And, you know, certainly they'll try and sell the consumer on, oh, we've, you know, increased our bandwidth here and there, and we've given you the option to do 4K streaming here and there, you know, so on and so forth. But the simple reality is that unless you have a watertight connection to the internet, wherever you're streaming these things, unless, you know, you've got your kit tricked out to the nines, you're probably still going to experience a little bit of loss, a little bit of, you know, degenerative material.
Compression again, of the image compression. And stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's something that, you know, it depends also on how discerning your eye is and your ear. If you're someone who, you know, doesn't really notice those things too much when you're watching something, then it's probably not going to matter that much to you, ultimately. If you are a tech head, if you're very into the whole thing, then you could get into the weeds, not just with streaming, but also with disc releases, because, as I was also going to bring up, there are a lot of variables involved in terms of the transfers themselves. Right now, there's so much discourse going on about the Criterion release of Eyes Wide Shut on 4K, and how the DP of that movie has approved this new transfer for the Criterion release, and how it differs from the wide release that most fans have been used to in watching the movie on disc and on streaming for the last, you know, 20, 30 years. So, you know, if you get into that sort of discussion, then that's a whole nother can of worms where, you know, we talk about William Friedkin's revisionist color timing on the French Connection releases or The Exorcist, you know, so there's a lot of variables involved in that. So if that's where your head's at, then you're basically going to have to really do your research and go onto message boards and, you know, all sorts of things for that specific film to figure out which transfer you think conforms to whatever the original vision of the film might have been, and whether or not you believe in director's authorship, where it's like, well, if they revise their creation, you know, later on, does that still mean it's valid? Does that still mean it's definitive or not? So that's what I mean about definitive. That's something for you as an individual to answer for yourself.
Real quick, Bill, just to interrupt you, is there a place, a forum or a website or something that you go to try to answer those questions for yourself when you're considering buying something, just in terms of, hey, here's a resource that you can use that might point you in the right direction?
Yeah, there's a couple of places. One good place that I tend to go to the most often is Blu-ray.com. It's Blu-ray.com. And they have a message board there that's extremely active on the daily. You're going to get a lot of chatter. And, you know, as the internet, you know, message boards go, there's good people and there's bad people. So you have to be wary of that. Customers forewarned. But if you want sort of a consensus really quickly about the latest, you know, rumor or the latest news about a certain release or, you know, that sort of thing, it's a good resource to use for sure. Then there's also hometheaterforum.com, which tends to be a little bit more calm in terms of its chatter on the message board threads. It's maybe not as active as Blu-ray.com, but it's still another good resource to check out. There's a guy who has been running a website called The Digital Bits for years and years. His name's Bill Hunt, and he's very active on social media. So if you follow him, you'll get a good, you know, general overview of the upcoming news about upcoming releases, as well as maybe occasionally some information on past releases, and really just, you know, utilizing search engines and sort of being able to suss out old links and old websites that may have done a DVD review or a Blu-ray review or a 4K review that can serve your needs. There's High Def Digest, there's DVD Beaver, there's Mondo Digital. So those are websites that you can use for, you know, archived reviews that can maybe give you a good idea of what's on a certain release and how the transfer looked and how the sound quality is.
Okay. Awesome. Just in terms of Wes's question about the 120 frames per second version of Gemini Man, that's the Ang Lee movie that starred Will Smith and a digital version, a younger version of Will Smith. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people like forgot that movie existed because it wasn't really that big of a thing when it came out a few years ago. I don't know the answer to whether or not we're going to see 120 FPS version of that movie. It seems very unusual for something like that to exist, but who knows? I mean, if there's a chance that like that kind of more movies start coming out in that format, I could definitely see a studio, I think it was Sony in this case, you know, trying to capitalize on whatever hot new trend is going on or something. But it's just, to me, it kind of seems unlikely. So I don't know. Where are you at with that?
Yeah, I think it's something that, like 3D and certainly like premium format, you know, offers for people going to movie theaters. It feels like the industry wants to kind of keep it separate right now. I don't see there's a huge demand for it on home media. As Wes mentions, it's, I guess, possible that they could, you know, provide a version of that in the way that sort of, quote unquote, it was intended to be seen. Obviously, the Avatar films have been upgraded, or whether you want to say upgraded or changed to 120 FPS. That's, you know, a thing that's happened in the past too, as well as the Hobbit films. So I don't know if there's enough demand for that version or those versions. It's potentially possible, obviously, but I don't know if it's something that really home media people are all that engaged in terms of like, oh, I really want to make sure that this gets out. Really, if you've something you want to see, I think it's worth, you know, posting on socials about, you know, say, hey, I would love to see the 120 FPS version of Gemini Man again. Hopefully, I don't know who owns that movie. Maybe it's Sony. I don't know. But
yeah, track down which studio and make sure you tag them propererly.
Yeah, obviously you can't just, you know, tag Warner Brothers if it's not a Warner Brothers movie. But, you know, yeah, find out which studio released it and has the rights to it. And you never know. If there's enough demand, it could happen. But just before we get away, I just wanted to say, if you're looking for definitive versions in terms of special features, generally Criterion, as you mentioned, Ben, is a great label to follow, as well as the boutique labels like Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, Umbrella, which is a label out of Australia, as well as Imprint, which is a division of Via Vision. And really, again, same kind of deal where it's like, if you look up an individual title on Blu-ray.com, you'll be able to sort of get a general sense of what extras are where. And I think in general, you can't go wrong with, you know, a Criterion or a Second Sight out of England, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So are there any, across the entire spectrum of all of these different boutique releases and Criterion releases and all these different companies that put out physical media these days, are there any shining lights, shining examples of like, this is the best a thing could possibly be, you know, like an edition of a movie, or maybe like there's a white whale out there that you have had your eye on for a long time that you want to get, Bill, or something like that, or just like any entries in your particular collection that you think might be good places for people to start if they're looking to build a great physical media collection in 2025?
Sure. And again, it all depends on your personal taste in terms of what movies, you know, speak to you the most and which ones are your favorites. But I would say that there are a couple of recent releases that really stand out to me in terms of, oh, there's very little that I can think of that could be added to this release that, you know, nothing that I could think of that could be added to this release to make it better. One is the recent release of the Spaghetti Western Dollars trilogy, the Sergio Leone Man with No Name trilogy that Arrow Video just put out this year on 4K, which is absolutely gorgeous. You know, it's a full restoration by them, as well as just every single special feature that's been released for each of these three movies over the last, you know, couple decades. So if you get those editions, you'll essentially have everything that you could possibly want on those movies. My white whale for the longest time, which I eventually did get when it came out, was Second Sight's release of George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead, the 78 version. And that release is just spectacular from all fronts in terms of it has everything that I could have wanted from it as a fan. Every single version of that movie, and there are several different cuts. There was the theatrical cut, the special edition cut, the Italian cut. Every single cut of the movie is on 4K, which is not something that happens often, even in boutique releases, because often what they'll do is they'll release the theatrical cut, you know, restored in 4K, but the director's cut will be Blu-ray only. But this is an instance where every single cut, they went to the trouble of releasing every single cut on 4K, as well as a full soundtrack containing every single library cue that's used in the movie that Romero and his editors pulled from just old ancient music library things, as well as the original score that Goblin did for the movie, as well as the original novelization, a reprint of the book that's in there, as well as new critical essays from a bunch of different writers in its own Perfect Bound book in there. It is just like, it's an incredible release. It's unfortunately very out of print now, but you can still get the discs and not the the printed material. And the discs are still worth the price of admission. And that still is in print. So you absolutely want to check that out if you're a fan of that movie.
Okay, man. Yeah, that's great. So just to, as we approach the end of our conversation here, I'm sure Wes knows this, but just in case there's anybody out there who's listening who, last time you bought a movie, it was on DVD in 2002 or something like that, and you're thinking about getting back into this, I just want to be clear that the 4K releases that we're talking about are different than Blu-rays. That's a different format, and it requires a different player too. So just because you have a bunch of Blu-rays or you have access to a bunch of Blu-rays does not necessarily mean that you'll be able to play a 4K or something. So just like, before you go out on a buying spree of buying movies that you're interested in, just do the research and make sure that you have the correct player. If you have like a PlayStation 5, that will play 4K discs. But there are certain, you know, just certain considerations to take into account before you go on a spree. And I'm guessing most of our listeners know this, but just in case, just wanted to throw that out there. So,
yeah. And I think the thing to keep in mind too, is that if you get a 4K player or certainly a PS5, which is what I use, you can still play most of your old discs, and that includes DVDs. So it's not something so bad as to be like you have to have several different players for each different type of disc. You know, as soon as you go 4K, you should be set for a wide variety of discs that you own.
Yeah, what's it called? It's reverse compatible, I think.
Yeah, reverse compatible,
yeah. Yeah. Yep. Awesome. Okay, cool. Well, any closing thoughts on any of this stuff, Bill? Anything we didn't get to, or just like the state of the physical media landscape right now?
Yeah, I think that it's we're in a really good place still, I think, in terms of how it's being treated. You can obviously, you know, make your complaints about price points, about packaging, about artwork, and God knows fans do. But I think that and you know, and obviously as I was describing earlier, if you want to get into the weeds of, oh, is this transfer better than that transfer? Is this sound mix better than this sound mix? You know, you can. And I think that ultimately that's not where I tend to go, because I think that's just a path to misery if you're, you know, that much of a purist. But again, you know, to each their own. I do think, though, that in general, you're going to find a lot of great stuff out there to learn, to experience, to have, to own. And the biggest advice I can offer is learn to fall in love with the joy of the hunt, so to speak. In the same way that I was talking about Tombstone, it wasn't a sadness to me when I found out, oh, there's a whole different director's cut that was put out in this, you know, out of print DVD that I could no longer access. You know, I looked online, and there is a website called eBay, which people can still use. And you'll find people that want to, you know, make some sales of their old collection and don't want their movies anymore, and it's that version that you've been looking for. And there's no better feeling in my book in terms of going on the hunt and getting your prize. So, you know, I think if you make peace with that and you learn to love that process rather than be frustrated by it, it's gonna pay dividends for you.
Excellent. Well, that's great advice, Bill, and thanks very much for your time. Where can people find you online?
They can find me on all socials at Bill Bria.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you so much, Ben.
That is going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stuff that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I've linked to a few articles in the show notes as well for you to be able to find those easily and access those things easily. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. We'd really appreciate that. And thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next time.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.